In January, the Powerball lottery jackpot hit a new high, one of the largest in U.S. history.
This is Powerball. Good evening, America. I'm Sam Arlen. Tonight, we have an estimated jackpot. It is worth $559.7 million. I hope you have your Powerball tickets. Good luck.
Wish I had that Powerball ticket. It's nearly $560 million, and it went to a woman from southern New Hampshire, not far from here. So far, all we know about the big winner is that she's a woman from southern New Hampshire. She's arguing in court for her right to remain anonymous and to have the name of a trust she's established to be public. She could have done that, but the problem is she had already signed the winning ticket with her name. And according to the New Hampshire Lottery, as we understand it, that means she must reveal her identity. A team of lawyers went to court this week to help her fight for her anonymity. Judge Nancy Gertner, perhaps you can help us make sense of this. WBUR's legal analyst, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Judge Gertner, so the instructions on the lottery website say the winner, to claim their ticket, needs to complete the back of the ticket with name, address, telephone number, and to sign the ticket. So she did this. But did she have to sign her name?
Well, the New Hampshire process allows for her to set up a trust and sign in the name of the trust. I mean, this is really about the formalities of the lottery. And the formalities are important on the one hand because a lot of money is involved and because you want some transparency. But here, the formality, is really a little challenging. That is to say, if she had written down the name of the trust that she subsequently created, she would have been able to keep her identity confidential. But because she didn't understand she could do that, she signed her own name. And now there is a formality, a rule that says you can't alter the back of the ticket once you signed it. I can't really predict where this is going to come out because on the one hand, when that amount of money is involved, you want to make sure that people dot their I's and cross their T's. On the other hand, it seems a little dopey her.
The six-year-old in me comes out and goes, but why?
Right,
why can't
right.
I just cross that out?
Because there are rules. I mean, I can't predict where this is going to go. So on the one hand, there are rules, and the rules are there because a lot of money is involved. I think that the argument that the lottery is making that it's important that she disclose her identity for interests of transparency, that makes no sense because she could have withheld her identity had she simply created the trust and signed it on behalf of the trust. So I think it's really more about changing the rules and some adherence to, formal rules rather than a situation that doesn't make sense.
And just to explain a little bit to listeners, the reason she wants to remain anonymous is fear for her safety and her family's safety. Mm-hmm. She wants to remain a regular person, as I understand it,
right.
To be able to go to the grocery store and not have somebody go, oh my God, that woman has $560 million.
Right. I mean, apparently the Boston Globe reported that the store that sold her the lottery ticket had gotten lots and lots of calls in which people were trying to find out what her identity is. So protecting her identity seems not an unreasonable thing to do. There's a mechanism for doing it. The problem was she didn't follow the rule. And the question is whether the rule has to be so rigidly enforced as to keep her from preserving her anonymity now. And I think that, I don't know what a judge would do in that situation. One part of me is like the six-year-old that says, really, if she could have done it one way, why don't you let her do it that way now? The problem is, I suppose, that they're concerned that if people regularly change the ticket after they've claimed it, it would open the door for fraud.
Is it important to parse also what she is specifically asking of the judge in this case, which was argued in Nashua, I believe, yesterday, and it's being expedited, that it is about a language change, I believe.
Right. And I think, as I said, you understand the rule that says, once you claim your ticket in the name of X, you can't change it because that could allow for fraud. Oh, I see you have $500 million. Now put my name in. I can see that there'd be a concern that there'd be a regularity to the process, but it's not clear to me that it makes sense in this case.
Right. And I apologize. I'm throwing this at you not knowing if you know. Has anyone in New Hampshire signed their ticket as a trust in the past?
I only know that is apparently allowable under the rules. So it's really the chronology here. She created the trust after she had signed the ticket. Then she found out that she could have signed the ticket as the trust. So the issue is really not the disclosure of her identity because there was a way of keeping her identity confidential. The issue is really about, formal rules about changing your name once you've signed them.
Right. And no pushback. And just to be clear, the lottery has announced that they are going to begin transferring funds into that trust if they haven't already, from what we understand from media reports. So things are moving forward, but it's unclear what the judge will rule and when she'll rule.
Right. And if she can already send the money into the trust, then the notion of disclosing her identity seems to me to be unnecessary. Transparency is one thing, but there's transparency in other parts of the process.
Okay. I'd love to tackle another issue with you, something that has been, immigration is the topic, and it's been, you know, the topic for on the news radar and in the courts for some time now. In federal court, 50 Indonesian Christian immigrants who live in New Hampshire will temporarily be allowed to stay in the country after a federal judge in Boston blocked their deportation. This has been happening in other courtrooms as well. This is until they have a chance to report, reopen their cases. This is U.S. District Judge Patty Saris, if I'm saying her name.
Saris, thank you. Yeah.
You might know each other from...
We do.
Yeah. She says that there's evidence that these immigrants would face, quote, the threat of persecution or torture if sent back to Muslim-majority Indonesia, and she's compared sending them back to... Indonesia with turning away Jewish immigrants during the start of the Holocaust,
right,
as we know it. Judge Gertner, remind us what power these federal judges have when it comes to deportation cases with immigrants who have been told by the feds it's time to leave.
Well, actually, as a district court judge, she doesn't have a lot of power to determine whether it is correct for them to stay. In other words, she can't rule that it is right for them to stay on the basis of their concern for being persecuted. But what she can do, and what she did do as a preliminary matter, was to say it is right for them to stay while they are litigating the question, while they are dealing with the question of whether or not they will be persecuted if they return. The chronology is interesting here. These are people who were under an order of deportation, many 2005, 2007. Then that order was stayed in 2010 by the Immigration Service because of concerns about persecution. Now all of a sudden, 2017, under the Trump administration, they are now ordered to leave immediately. And what they want to do is say that between 2010, when you allowed us to stay in the country, and 2017, the situation has changed in Indonesia. Were we to go back, we would be tortured or killed.
Well, what do you make of the judge's comparison to the Holocaust? It's a very bold statement from a judge. It is... it's very emotional as well. It brings up a lot of thought about this country and when we have opened our doors or not.
No, I thought it was a very interesting analogy. I mean, what she's talking about is the ship, the St. Louis, which had left Europe with largely Jewish refugees. This was after Kristallnacht, after it was clear what the German administration was doing.
Is this 1939?
1939. It was clear that what the Germans were doing. And these were then refugees from an increasingly aggressive German regime against the Jews. They were supposed to go to Havana initially and await visas to the United States. Something was going on in Havana. They couldn't land in Havana, and the American government turned them around. Many of them then perished, as I understand it, in the Holocaust. So the analogy is that we have been a welcoming country. There are all these provisions that we have allowed people to stay when there's a real threat of torture. The analogy I thought was actually an interesting one and an important one. Actually, it has to be said that what they're saying here is not give me the right to stay in the United States permanently. They're not saying that. They're saying give me an opportunity to litigate whether or not I should stay.
And as they do not have refugee status, they were not granted refugee status.
They were not. They were temporarily in this country under an order allowing them to stay in 2010. And so what happened here is that all of a sudden, really, it's very, very troubling that our government behaves like this. I have to sort of interject that. In 2017, they get an order from this government that says leave in 60 days. Leave in 60 days. People had been in this country for 15 years and had been allowed by the prior administration to stay so long as they checked in, and they did.
But as I understand it, these hard rules on immigration were put in place under the Clinton administration, not under the Trump administration.
But
were they ignored?
No, the Clinton administration basically took away federal judges' power to district court judge's power to determine whether someone had a right to stay in the country. There's no question that the bones of a harsh immigration policy began under Clinton and continued under Obama. But nothing was like this. That is to say, what was it, 2 or 3 months ago, suddenly an order that said, leave now. That's the difference between today's situation and what had happened under Clinton and Obama. Certainly, people were being deported and judges' jurisdiction, federal judges, district court judges' jurisdiction to control the outcomes. That changed. So they have limited procedural rights. Okay. But the notion of saying get out now is eliminating whatever procedural rights they have.
So with we have about a minute left. These are delay tactics. These are delay tactics that judges who do not see eye to eye with ICE or the federal immigration officer's decision to leave now, delay for how long, you know?
Well, the order that she issued said they cannot be deported until they have an opportunity to raise the question of the legitimacy of their leaving before the immigration authorities and before they have an opportunity to appeal that to the Court of Appeals.
All right. I just want to make sure it's clear that this is a district court judge. There are federal judges who have also made rulings that halt individual and some mass deportations, and we'll have to just watch and see how these play out. Judge Nancy Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For joining us. Always such insight. WBUR legal analyst Judge Gertner will be meeting with you again, I'm sure. Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.